This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Tuesday, time to talk politics. And I doubt Prime Minister Mark Carney realized what he was about to unleash when he made this flip comment.
Who cares? I mean, it's a detail. It's a detail. I spoke to him. I'll speak to him again when it matters.
Okay, well, to me, it sounded like somebody trying to sound like they didn't care about being snubbed by someone more powerful. But Carney got his answer in a hurry from Pierre Poilievre.
Mr. Speaker, we care. We care about the workers who've lost their jobs and don't have paychecks to make their mortgage payments. Why doesn't he care?
Well, now we hear that Carney may go to Washington next week. So my question is, does he have a meeting set? With whom? And yesterday, the Ford government introduced tough new rules on posting bail, namely that those promising actually have to put up the money, which I was shocked to learn only recently that this has not been the case. Now, as you know, I am normally on the tough side of things. And I firmly believe that the lack of consequences for a whole raft of things has taken us to bad places in our society. But this time, I'm also thinking about the loved ones of the accused. So, for instance, if you have a child who is a suspect or even a previously convicted criminal, well, you still love that child and would want to help them within the bounds of the law, which is innocent until proven guilty. But it looks like families without money won't be able to do that. So what would be an appropriate accommodation without maintaining the free-for-all that we have now? I'm keen to hear from our listeners also, especially if you have had an experience putting up bail. The numbers to call: 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-744-740.
And now, the Recovering Politicians Panel.
And now I'd like to welcome John Molloy, a former Ontario Liberal MPP who served as a cabinet minister under Dalton McGuinty, and Kathleen Wynne, Sherry DeNovo, a former NDP MPP, and Lisa Raitt, former deputy leader of the Conservative Party of Canada. And let's start with this issue of bail reform, of having to come up with bail. We've all heard so many stories about people skipping out on bail, not fulfilling their bail conditions. And again, I was very surprised to learn that there's no money involved, that if somebody agrees to be what's called a surety, they promise to pay, and that if it ever comes to it, the province doesn't even bother to collect it. So, Lisa, what's your take on this?
I'm kind of with you, Libby. I actually didn't realize that money wasn't put up front. And it's sad because I'm a lawyer and I did go to law school, but I wasn't aware. I don't have a problem with this at all. I can understand that, you know, just because you are charged does not mean you are guilty. No question about that. However, if there's enough evidence to charge you, then I think it's okay to go into a bail hearing and expect somebody to put some money up to make sure that they don't reoffend, because we can point to the fact that there are people who are on bail who are breaching their obligations under bail and committing other crimes. So put some money up and see whether or not they're going to do that quickly.
Well, yeah, but what about this whole issue that, I mean, Civil Liberties Association said it creates, you know, different justice systems for people with money and without. I mean, again, I take the example of a child. I mean, you know, people love their children. They want to help their children. And what do you do about that, Lisa?
Well, I think excellent question. And I think what it comes down to is, as the details are rolled out, I mean, the concept is sound as far as I'm concerned. The details should be rolled out for certain situations and cases, just like you're saying, where there is hardship involved, where somebody can make an application for some relief on that. And I don't know whether or not that's a possibility in the legislation, but they have to do something about the revolving door of bail, because bail seems to be given in every circumstance, and there it's very rarely that you don't get it. There's a reverse onus on bail to prove there any reason why you shouldn't have to be kept on bail.
Well, yeah, that's the directive. Sherry, what's your view?
Well, first of all, our jails are full to overflowing. Talk to any corrections officer. And most of the people in them are awaiting trial. They haven't been convicted yet or found innocent yet. And also, of course, this is one system for the rich, another for the poor justice system. And to the point of absurdity, I remember, you know, when I was in church on Roncesvalles, a very poor area at that time, has kind of come up a bit since then. But I mean, a lot of people who were homeless were being given tickets for vagrancy. Well, they had no money. So, I mean, it was just ludicrous. There's no way they were ever going to collect on those tickets. And quite frankly, just meant that they would go to jail, which is in some cases they were looking forward to because it kept them out of the cold. I mean, this is ludicrous. This is this debtor prison, basically. I mean, it's Charles Dickens time of year. You know, we don't want to be Scrooge. This makes no sense. Courts are backlogged. You know, they're not getting to cases fast enough. Why don't you put some money, I would say, Mr. Fort, into the justice system and stop trying to get it out of people who don't have any?
Well, I mean, I think there's a big difference between vagrancy and the kinds of horrible, violent crimes that we are seeing. And we keep hearing that it's the same few violent criminals, and it is a revolving door, and they breach their bail, and there's no consequence with not putting up bail. That the province, that the surety promises, doesn't fulfill the promise, the province doesn't even bother to try to.
But Libby, our violent crime stats have gone, you know, consistently down. Like if it leads, it leads. I think part of our problem is the media coverage. But I agree with your sentiment that you spoke of at the beginning of the show, which is, you know, if you don't have the money, you're guilty until proven innocent in this system.
Well, I didn't quite say it that way. I said I see a problem with it, but I'm hoping there's some kind of accommodation, because I think, John Malloy, that what we have now is a bit of a free-for-all. What's your view?
Well, my view is what's the problem we're trying to solve? The problem we're trying to solve is that there are bad folks who are allowed to leave the system, who are accused of a serious crime and allowed to leave the system on bail when they shouldn't, because there's evidence that they may reoffend, that they are a danger to our communities. That whole question is actually a federal question, not a provincial question. Now, you know, in fairness, the federal government always loves to muck about in provincial matters. So I guess Doug Ford wants to be the federal justice minister. And by coincidence, 1 month ago, the Carney government brought forward legislation, which is not passed yet, which is going to strengthen the bail system and allow judges more discretion in keeping the bad folks in. So if that's the problem you're trying to solve, I'm with Sherry, and I guess to a degree with you. It basically, the message that's being sent is people with lots of money aren't going to reoffend, but people with no money will reoffend. That doesn't make any sense. Let's strengthen the laws. That's a federal matter. The feds have it. I'm not an expert. I mean, you know, the Mr. Polyev and others have said it doesn't go far enough, and you can have that discussion. But, you know, this sounds like Doug Ford, who's in a bit of trouble right now, trying to play, you know, he pushes around people in Home Depot parking lots. He goes after, I mean, you know, he's trying to create this image about himself when there's kind of healthcare and education and social services and all that, which are provincial matters that perhaps he should be focusing on.
Okay, let's take a call from Don in Hamilton. Hello, Don.
Hi, Libby. Well, yeah, it's a balance of justice. However, with the bail reform, somebody who has been, you know, let out on bail 2, 3, 4 times, you know, to your point, do their parents love them? I don't know. It's their parents so far have failed them. So for repeat offenders, people who are violently breaking into people's homes, smash and grab in jewelry stores, you know, people always want to focus in on the poor young kid who just did a mistake. No. Write the law. Make the judges understand that the people who are repeating, breaking into people's homes in the middle of the day, robbing people of their cars, forcing them out of their cars, that's the next level. And those people absolutely should have to put up bail. Front and center.
Well, and a lot of those people are young offenders, so
So where were their parents?
Well, yeah, but I mean, you can't always blame parents.
Oh, yes, you can. Yes, you can. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. There's a reason for that saying, Libby. Come on. We have to start addressing systemic issues here. Children that are allowed to run the roads at 12 o'clock at night and mom doesn't know where they are, dad doesn't know where they are. Yes, we got a problem. And actually, perhaps with this bail reform, don't look at it as a punishment. Look at it as a life preserver.
Oh.
The state stepping in and saying, okay, we got a problem here. Let's deal it if they're 14, 15, 16. Let's deal with it now before they're 19, 20 and end up in Kingston.
Okay, Jody. I'm sorry. That's Dawn. We're going to Jody, who wants to talk about Carney's statement, the who cares. Hi, Jody. Are you there? Jody, are you there? Okay. Oh, I bleeped you, Jody. I'm sorry. Please call back. There are gremlins in the phones today, but let's ask the panel about it. So, Lisa, what did you make of the whole who cares thing?
Well, just take it from a political point of view. I can certainly understand the frustration the Prime Minister was feeling when he said what he said to a reporter. The optics aren't great. It was a female reporter, and it's the second time he's been short or curt with a female reporter. But secondly, the soundbite lifted is going to prove to be a great campaign tool for any opposition party, quite frankly. It's just a really quick soundbite. And as they say in politics, when you're explaining, you're losing. And they have to explain why he said, what the context was, what it really meant. And that means that the upper hand is given to opposition of all flavor. I think the NDP as well are taking a look at this who cares moment in terms of what they're going to craft around in their narrative. It's very unfortunate for the Prime Minister. I also think that he's wrong. I think people do care. And that he needs to prioritize at least helping Canadians understand where we are with the United States and also maybe have his folks explain to him just how it's impacting on the ground, because I don't know whether or not that information is going all the way to the top.
Well, I mean, again, Sherry, to me, it sounded like somebody who was trying to cover up the fact that the big guy was snubbing him by saying, well, I don't care. That's what it sounded like to me.
Well, I think really in terms of under the umbrella of the elbows up, that Carney has been a real disappointment. I mean, you know, when you start looking at where the money's going, you know, he said this is supposed to be about Buy Canadian, and it isn't. I mean, he's, you know, the F-35 jets are American made, Lockheed Martin, and that's a big chunk of the military budget. I mean, like, there are real problems with, you know, there's a difference between what he's saying and what he's doing. And this was, as Lisa said, this is a stupid error. And he's, you know, it shows that he's still a little green around the gills in terms of politics. So, I mean, there is that. But I mean, I think the broader problem is, you know, where is the results? You know, like, what has he actually accomplished in terms of standing up to Trump? And I think I and most voters say can't answer that question, and that's not good.
John, do we know if he now says maybe I'll go next week? Does he have a meeting? Is it with Trump?
Well, all I know is what I've seen in the media about the speculation. I guess it's around FIFA, the World Cup. There's a draw or a meeting about the World Cup that Canada is helping to host. But just let me jump in to maybe push back a bit on my esteemed colleagues here. I mean, we keep saying we don't want to be a 51st state. So let's stop acting like a 51st state. We're dealing with an erratic government where the tune changes, forget every day, every hour. And, you know, running around like some high school student wondering, is he going to call? Is he not going to call? How about getting on with the business of diversifying our markets, internal trade, large infrastructure projects? Yeah, I admit politically it didn't come across that well with the don't care. But I think what he was trying to express is at the end of the day, he's got a big to-do list, a very ambitious agenda, which is about weaning Canada off U.S. Dominance. And you know what? If we're not going to be the 51st state, at the end of the day, you know, we've got more important things to do than wait around whether he's going to call or not. And then tomorrow someone's going to, you know, say something to offend him and he's going to change his mind. Like I actually think good for Mr. Carney in going off to the G20 on trying to reestablish ties with India, of trying to broaden our markets and not getting into this soap opera that's taking place on Pennsylvania Avenue.
Okay, let's take that call from Jody on Carney's statement. Hi, Jody, go ahead.
Hi, Libby. The other part of the statement was he has no burning issue to discuss with Trump at the moment. No burning issue. What happened with the tariffs and this catastrophe that we were experiencing and the crisis and the whatever? This is another backtrack for him. I think, Libby, what's happening is he knows he cannot get a deal with him, with Trump, and he's going to try to kick this thing down the road past the primary, the elections coming up, and hopefully things will improve. But there's no way that he's going to get a deal with Trump. And both he and Ford, Doug Ford, have really closed their mouths totally about the tariffs and about the car industry and the lumber and the this and the that. Not a peep from them. They cannot get a deal, and all he's doing is stalling and hoping that Trump will go away because he cannot do anything about it.
He was at the G20, and he is talking about, you know, getting trade alternatives. Now, he had some talks with Narendra Modi of India, trying to repair that relationship, and said, gee, you know, we can have economic ties with countries that we don't agree with. So he's backing away a bit from the way Justin Trudeau conducted things. But between Modi and Xi in China, these are two countries that have meddled in our domestic affairs in very dangerous ways. The allegation that the Indian government murdered a Canadian citizen on Canadian soil, and all manner of, you know, talking about Chinese police stations and keeping tabs on Canadian citizens who are part of that diaspora. I mean, is he going too easy on those countries, Lisa?
Absolutely. And you just can't fill in the gap that the United States leaves. That's just a reality. It's such a big one. By the way, on the I do think the prime minister is going to go to America. I think it's because around FIFA, and it's because I've read that FIFA is going to give a World Peace Prize to Donald Trump during this time when they're drawing the games that are going to be happening. And I think there's a danger that if Canada doesn't show up, Canada doesn't get any games. I don't think he has a choice. He's got to go down and kiss the ring of Trump.
Okay, well, so do a lot of other people. I mean, yeah, what can I say? So you think, do you at all buy what he says, that we can have economic ties with countries like India and China while still not liking a lot of the things they do?
For me, you can have some ties. You have to have some ties. But as I was saying, you have to have your eyes wide open. You got to make sure it's the amount that you're comfortable with. And as well, you can't turn your back on other parts of the world in terms of trade. And that's what I hope they do.
Okay. What is your take on that, John?
Well, you know, I'm just a little confused by the strategy that everyone seems to be talking about. I mean, I may be a liberal, but I was quite frankly embarrassed, and even more embarrassed the more I think about it, about Justin Trudeau going down to Mar-a-Lago for that ridiculous dinner where he basically said, "Will you be my friend, Donald?" And I think part of the reason he's no longer prime minister is because of that. Like, there seems to be this assumption that if you suck up to Donald Trump, you'll get what you want. Well, we tried that and we didn't get what we wanted. I think we have to have a position of strength. And I give credit to Mr. Carney, the fact that he is trying to expand our markets, the fact that he's not sitting around waiting for the phone to ring, that he's going out and trying to create a stronger, more independent Canada. I think that gives us in the long run a much better negotiating position than trying to hang around the Oval Office and hope that, you know, he likes you one day and hates you the next. I mean, it's become so ridiculous. And yet what I'm hearing from a lot of commentators, your caller and other ones, is that he should somehow be like Justin Trudeau and fly down to Mar-a-Lago. I thought that was one of the most embarrassing moments for our country. That ridiculous dinner, which actually was I think this week, it was Thanksgiving week, a year and a bit ago.
Sherry, what's your take on cozying up to India and China?
Well, you know, when you dine with the devil, you better have a very, you know, long spoon kind of thing. I kind of agree with the other panelists in different ways. Absolutely, we have to broaden our trade. We've been too banana republic with the United States for too long. And, you know, I seem to remember back to, I'm old, you know, the red Tory days when, you know, there was a real sentiment against, you know, American involvement and American ownership of our industry, and that's gone by the by. And so we need to, I think, return to more of that. Absolutely. So there's that. And I also agree with John that, you know, cozying up to Trump is no better than cozying up to Modi or, yeah, I mean, this is, you know, all of these countries interfere with ours. U.S. does too. I mean, there's a lot of buzz about how they've interfered with a, you know, Independence Alberta movement. So, I mean, they interfere with where they can, and so does India and so does China, and we have to be on guard for that. And CSIS warns us. But we have to trade with the world. And so, yeah, I mean, that is what we expect of Carney, but we also expect results.
Okay. Final thing, very interesting article in the National Post on Carney's announcement that he is no longer going to have a gender positive aid projects, and that we have apparently spent something like $30 million under Justin Trudeau to support foreign aid projects that apparently are gender inclusive, and they include gender inclusive demining and gender just low carbon rice value chains and intersectional democratic spaces in Nepal and Bangladesh, and the list goes on. And it looks like Carney is moving away from some of the more, I would say, woke Justin Trudeau approaches that cost us a lot of money. Lisa.
Yeah, two things on this one I find interesting. Number one, I believe that he had to make that statement, so it's clear that he's not going to be going into world multilateral discussions with this as a talking point or this as a condition of engaging with Canada, which was something that Justin Trudeau did do. Second point, though, is I would encourage you to think that, yeah, the title sounds extremely woke-ish. Sometimes it just boils down to helping women and girls in other parts of the country where they desperately need help. And that stuff does need to be funded. And I got not a conflict, but Libby, I do sit on the board of something called Care Canada, where we do these kinds of projects around the world for women and young girls. And that's probably a bias that I should tell you I have. Sorry.
Okay. Well, no, there are projects that sound good, but I don't know about gender just rice. But I'm looking at the clock. We're out of time, so I am going to wrap things up. We'll all talk again soon. Thank you so much, John Molloy, Sherry DeNovo, and Lisa Raitt. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye, everyone.
Okay, we're taking a break, and when we come back, one of my favorite subjects and a very special day today, it's the Zoomer Radiothon in support of the Princess Margaret Cancer Center, and we will be talking more about it with Dr. Aaron Shimer when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, today here at Zoomer Radio, we are holding an annual event that is very near and dear to me. It's the Zoomer Radiothon to benefit the Princess Margaret Cancer Center. As many of our listeners know, I have survived three primary cancers, two of which have very low survival rates. But I'm here because of the excellent treatment I received at the Princess Margaret. Now, just to set things up, here's a clip from the documentary about my recent treatment for stomach cancer. We launched the documentary last week on Vision TV.
At the present time, seeing where this tumor remains, even though it has receded in size, to remove this would still require removal of the remainder of the stomach.
Okay, yeah.
Probably a removal of the remainder of the pancreas.
I think that's kind of a non-starter.
And then probably the spleen as well, Libby, just based on the contiguous relationship of all these organs.
I'm a little surprised that it's not more operable.
What I'd like to talk to Dr. Alamova about is how much more of a response can we anticipate? And I would personally advocate for additional chemotherapy, and if you're already lined up and scheduled for this week, I would go for it.
It sounds to me like the whole question of surgery isn't completely imminent, that the next question is, can we get it to shrink
even more?
Well, that's a clip from the sequel I never expected, and I think it really highlights the ups and downs of cancer treatment that hundreds and thousands of people experience, because there's a lot of uncertainty in the whole process. The one thing that you get at Princess Margaret, though, is very innovative and very caring cancer treatment, and that's what the Princess Margaret is famous for. So first, people, if you want to call, share your story, the numbers 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And I am now joined by Dr. Aaron Schimmer, the Director of Research at the Princess Margaret Cancer Center. Hi, Dr. Schimmer.
Hi, good to be with you.
Thank you for being with us. So every year I ask, what are the biggest or the most promising new things on the horizon in terms of cancer treatment?
So we continue to make tremendous strides in cancer. Each year, our investigators, our clinicians and scientists publish over 1,200 new papers in the medical and scientific literature, and each one represents a breakthrough, some smaller and some bigger. But, you know, it's amazing to think over the last year even what's been discovered. So work, for example, by Dr. Laura Dawson, who's shown that adding radiation therapy to standard care in patients with advanced liver cancers can improve survival. Work by Dr. Gang Zhang, who's working on what we call a nanoparticle, essentially a ball of fat that hones directly to cancer cells and allows us to see cancer at the earliest stages, increasing the opportunity for early detection and cure. And now even blood tests that can identify minute amounts of cancer DNA in the blood, offering again the opportunity for early detection, and through early detection, the opportunities to increase cure rates. So progress in cancer is probably best measured over several years, decades, but each year it's remarkable what our clinicians and scientists at the Princess Margaret are doing.
Yeah, and one of the things that happens is that you find something, a drug, whether it's chemotherapy or immunotherapy or a targeted therapy, and you find that it works for one type of cancer, and then, you know, over the course of a few years, well, you find it works for other cancers, other illnesses as well.
Yes, exactly. That's really kind of one of the remarkable things about cancer. You know, we now know that cancer is really many, many diseases, probably thousands and thousands of diseases, each one's type of cancer being very unique. But despite that uniqueness, there are also commonalities that in the pathways being hijacked by the cancer cells that extend to more than one cancer type. And through the research that's being done here at Princess Margaret and around the world, we're understanding the inner workings of cancer cells. It allows us to do exactly what you've said, apply therapies and learnings that you've got from one type of cancer for one group of patients into a group of cancers that are seemingly increasingly incredibly different. So therapies that might be used for some types of chronic blood cancers like leukemia could even be applied to treatments for melanoma, cancers that you wouldn't think would be related at all, but have both hijacked a common pathway that we can now target.
It's all very interesting. And on the other side of it as well, you know, during the course of my treatment, what's called immunotherapy, which harnesses the immune system, which by definition is different in every patient. And I know that I got some very bad side effects. And when they started, the doctor said, oh, this is very rare. And by the time we were done treating them, it was, oh, you know, X number of my other patients had the same things happening as well. So these fairly new treatment that, like immunotherapy, that's been around 15 years. I mean, you at the Princess Margaret keep learning.
Indeed. So immune therapy, if you go back 20, 25 years ago, immune therapy, they would have told you is impossible. It's a pipe dream. You can't harness the immune system to attack cancer. But fast forward to today, we've got multiple immune-based therapies for cancer, drugs that stimulate the patient's own immune system to recognize and attack cancer, the infusion of antibodies that can seek out and destroy the cancer cells, or even infusing genetically engineered immune cells that are also able to recognize, attack, and destroy the cancer. And so, yes, remarkably, we continue to learn about how these treatments are best used, the diseases, the cancers for which patients can benefit from the therapy, and also, perhaps surprisingly, even side effects, particularly the rare ones that come as a result of learning more and using more of these therapies. Now, interestingly, in immune therapy, sometimes having those side effects is also a sign that the treatment is working well, because it's a sign that you've stimulated and ramped up the immune system to attack the cancer.
Okay, well, I think that's probably what happened in my case, though. It wasn't a very pleasant sign
Some of these can be very serious. Look, I mean, some of these can be serious or even life-threatening. So, again, this is not a type of therapy that you give someone, you inject it and say, I'll see you in 6 months. You really need close observation, and sometimes when it even requires hospitalization to monitor for those potentially rare but very serious side effects. But, again, rest assured, that with the proper monitoring, we do have lots of treatments for them.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And it was interesting, you know, we saw one of my doctors a week ago at the launch of this documentary, and he said, you know, I was seen. The other thing is Princess Margaret is part of the University Health Network, and the collaboration with people from different specialties to deal with something like a side effect is really extraordinary. And I was seeing a number of doctors with other specialties other than oncology. And he said to me, and it was fine, he said to me, you know, if this was happening today, we would probably have to admit you. And I was thinking, good thing that I didn't have to be admitted. But anyway.
Yes, indeed. And really that highlights what a great environment Princess Margaret sits in. I mean, not only do you have an incredible cancer center with fantastic clinicians and scientists, but as you said, you sit within an incredible environment, the environment of UHN, with expertise across disease sites, but also near SickKids and the Toronto General and the University of Toronto. So whatever you're working on, there's an expert within 5 minutes around who can help you, either on the clinical side as you need it or on the research side.
Hmm. So what are you most excited about coming down the pike?
So I think we're going to continue to see major advances in our area of early detection, being through imaging, such as what I've mentioned with Dr. Gang Zhang, the ability to visualize cancer early, but also excitingly through the use of blood tests that can detect cancer at its earliest stages. I think you're going to see tremendous advances in the areas of new therapies, moving what we like to say beyond classic chemotherapy. And actually, one of the things that I think is most exciting is that in 10 years from now, I don't know what we're going to discover, but I know it's going to be able to do things that today we considered impossible, and I'm confident we're going to be able to do it because we've got the greatest scientific and medical minds working on it.
I want to ask a few questions about those blood tests, because I remember a time when we were told, well, blood test isn't going to catch things because it's sort of too nonspecific. And even with, you know, blood tests for, say, prostate cancer, it's too nonspecific. You don't know exactly where the problem is. So what's changed to make them better?
Exactly. So there's been a tremendous evolution of the use of blood tests in cancer screening. So years, probably decades ago, blood cancer tests for cancer relied on the detection of certain proteins. And they were not very specific. These protein levels could go up for any number of reasons. They could be associated with any number of things. And so if you had a positive test result, it would ultimately lead to further testing, which in many cases showed it wasn't cancer. But actually, you ended up going through a very significant process of probing and biopsying. And today, the blood tests, especially if you can combine them with standard cancer detection things such as colonoscopies or mammograms, or in some patients, MRI scans, you can now not only identify from the blood test that there may be a sign of cancer there, but importantly, the blood test tells you where to specifically look for the cancer.
And again, how does it tell you that? What is it identifying?
Right. So the blood test is what it's able to do is detect very minute amounts of cancer DNA in the bloodstream, essentially find that needle in the haystack. So among all the DNA that you would normally have in the bloodstream, there's a unique fingerprint or signature when the DNA comes from the cancer cell. And so we've discovered that different cancer sites, different cancer organs, that type of DNA that they secrete into the bloodstream, although very, very, very small amounts, can also be very telltale signs of that specific cancer. So using the genetic structures, doing the genetic codes, that can then help not only identify that, yes, we think there's a chance of cancer there, but where to look for it in the body.
Okay, and are those tests readily available? Or are they still being developed?
You know, it's one of those things that's coming into the market now. I would describe it as a very emerging technology. These are things which are approved and are just starting to be taken up. We're particularly using them, however, not necessarily in just the average person walking off the street, because it would have to be balanced with a number of what we call false positives and the need for extra investigation. But I think you're seeing this used more and more in patients who've had cancer, where we're looking to detect early evidence of recurrence to intervene early, or in patients, for example, those with high-risk hereditary syndromes, or patients at very high risk of developing cancer who don't yet have it, you would look to employ these. And again, this is what I would call cutting-edge, state-of-the-art, somewhere sitting between something you'd get from your family doc's office and something that's truly just an only research test.
Okay, well, that is very exciting. Thank you so much for that, Dr. Aaron Schimmer.
Thank you.
Okay, people, and to donate, visit ZoomerRadiothon.ca or ClassicalRadiothon.ca or text HOPE, H-O-P-E, to 80100 or call 1-888-388-3308. And again, a great cause, and reach in there, and it's a great place to make your donation. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the latest information about a very historic church, St. Anne's. 18 months ago, a terrible fire, and we will get an update. Thanks.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, yesterday we learned that the June 2024 fire that destroyed the historic St. Anne's Anglican Church in Toronto is now a suspected arson. Now, that's the bad news. The church contained murals painted by Group of Seven members J.E.H. MacDonald, Frank Carmichael, and Frederick Varley that decorated the chancel and the dome. They were destroyed in the fire. Now, the good news is, while many of us believe that all the church's artworks were destroyed, several canvases were salvaged, and they are being restored, or some of them have been restored. And I want to get an update on that. I'm now joined by Bishop Kevin Robertson with the Anglican Diocese of Toronto. Bishop Robertson, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome, Libby. It's great to be with you today. Thanks for your interest in this story.
Well, first of all, what's your reaction that this is now suspected as an arson?
Well, I heard the news before the congregation did on Sunday, though I was with them on Sunday morning as they heard it. I was with them for their worship service and then for the meeting that followed. And the Toronto Police Service detective who's been really leading the investigation was also with us. So he was the one who shared the news with the community. And maybe, as you can imagine, like it was devastating. I think some people had speculated that it might be arson, but you may remember that initially they said they were not suspicious. It didn't seem to be anything suspicious. So for some people, I think it really landed hard. And there were some tears in the room, of course, as the news was shared. And people, are still digesting the news that it's suspected arson.
And is there a suspect? Is an arrest imminent, or has there been an arrest?
That's really out of my league. That's something to ask the Toronto Police Service. Certainly the detective didn't allude to any of the details because it's an ongoing investigation. He made clear what he was able to talk about and what he wasn't able to talk about, and that was in the latter category. He wasn't able to speculate about those things.
And do you have any inkling of whether this may have been perpetrated by someone with a connection to the church or someone with no connection to the church?
I really don't know, and I don't think anybody knows at this stage unless the police know. And that's part of their investigation, and I wouldn't know that. But, we thought when the fire happened, and I'm the bishop for St. Anne's, so I'm there on a fairly regular basis, and, you know, we speculated, were there candles that were burning that weren't put out? Was it an electrical fire in an old building? So I think people wondered whether it was something else, but now that they know that it's suspected arson, I think that hits at a new level. But really, we don't have any sense of who the suspect or suspects might be at this stage.
Okay, well, let's talk about the good news, because I think those of us in the wider community were very sad that these really precious and irreplaceable artworks were destroyed. But now we learn that some have been or are in the process of being salvaged. Tell us about those.
Yeah, you're quite right. I mean, the fire was so devastating. And if you've been by the site, you'll know that it's really just a structure now with four walls and no roof. And there's nothing inside it, except for the fact that some things were able to be salvaged. Three pieces, in particular, a group of seven pieces, which are still in the process of being restored. And what I find most inspiring, Libby, is the mosaic. You know, there were mosaics up at the front of the church, and the center panel that was behind the altar was almost virtually untouched. There's a little bit of blackness on it from, I don't know, maybe a beam fell against it while it was burning. So there's a little bit of damage to it. But otherwise, that central mosaic panel remains. And the one on either side, the left and the right, were destroyed. But so we have a mosaic, and we have these three pieces that are in the process of being restored. And that's, I mean, we're never going to recreate what was there, of course, because it was stunning and one of a kind and irreplaceable. But to have a few pieces that we're going to be able to take forward with us as a community is really encouraging for us.
So what is depicted on that panel of the mosaic and the other pieces that are being restored?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I can't get into the details of it because they're quite complex. The mosaic is stunning. And by the way, a few pieces of the glass have fallen off. And somebody who is gifted in restoration has been tasked with making sure that they're put back on in the right way. So there's ongoing maintenance of the mosaic, which is on the site, obviously. It's in the wall. And the three pieces are out for restoration, and I haven't seen them since the fire. But I think on the St. Anne's website, I think you can probably get a better sense of what they look like. Can I just also say the other good news about this is that the community at St. Anne's has not stopped being the community. I mean, they've continued to meet on Sunday mornings since the Sunday after the fire, and they haven't stopped. So they're still doing the work that they've always done, and social outreach into the community, advocacy, you know, care for the marginalized, all that stuff has continued to happen. And of course, they continue to pray together and gather on Sundays. So the fire destroyed the building, but the fire didn't destroy the church, if you see what I mean.
I do. So where do you pray? Where does the community pray now?
There's a huge parish hall. So the church itself had its front on Gladstone Avenue. And just west of there, on the same piece of property, but fronting onto Dufferin, there's a large parish hall there. And on the main floor, there's a hall, like a theater, without furniture in it. Well, it didn't have furniture in it. And we've recreated the sacred space there. Now, as you can imagine, it looks completely different than the old church that was full of...
Which was beautiful.
Stunning. And this is a makeshift space. But it's makeshift while we make plans to build something new. And I think that's also part of the exciting thing about this story.
And you are going to build a new church, the diocese?
Our plan, the diocese with the parish, is to build something new. And we have been working with an architect, and we have what we've been calling a discernment committee of parish leaders and diocesan leaders, including me. And we've been working with an architect to imagine what might be possible on the site, not somewhere else, but on, you know, either within the ruins or next to the ruins. The ruins have been stabilized, so the four walls are still standing, although there's nothing inside them. So there are lots of possibilities there, I think.
However, the congregation, I think your regular congregation is quite small, and you know, we keep hearing about dwindling church attendance and churches that are turned into condos and things like that. So what do you have, about 70 or 80 regulars in your congregation?
Yeah, that's a really good guess, or maybe you knew that before you called me, but that's about right. And the old building, as you may remember, you know, it would seat like 700 people. So we don't have a need for it to rebuild a church of that size. And as I said earlier, we'd never be able to replicate that anyway. But we do want to build a place for the current worshiping community and for the work that it's doing in the local neighborhood. So something on a smaller scale. And as I say, an architect's been able to help us do some dreaming and some imagining about what that might be.
In terms of restoration and rebuilding, is the Archdiocese taking care of those costs? Are you fundraising for it? How's that happening?
Yeah, so there's been a GoFundMe page out there ever since the day of the fire, I think, that was set up kind of privately. But St. Anne's continues to collect money through its own website, and the diocese continues to raise funds in an informal way. I think when we get to the place where we've decided on what we want and we want to go for it, we're obviously going to need to do some fundraising in order to make that happen. The other possibility is that, you know, are there opportunities to generate some revenue in different ways? And, you know, the Diocese of Toronto is committed to affordable housing in the city and beyond. And is there some way of building housing with an affordable component to it that might generate some funds? I mean, who knows? It's too early to say what that might look like in specifics. But I think we're beginning to think about how we might fund that project.
Okay. Bishop Kevin Robertson, thanks so much for being with us.
Libby, thanks so much. I really appreciate you taking some interest in this story.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay, people, before I sign off, I want to go over the details about the Zoomer Radiothon again. So to donate, visit zoomerradiothon.ca or classicalradiothon.ca. Text HOPE, H-O-P-E, to 80100 or call 1-888-388-3308. I will be back here tomorrow. We'll talk then. And that's it for Fight Back with Libby Znaimer for today.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.